Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Fantastic, man.
Just tickety-boo.
Just tickety-boo. Tickety-boo. Hey, do you remember...
dog.
Do you remember...
No.
We mostly know him as Raccoon, but Randy.
Randy. Yes, Randy. I know Randy.
Randy reached out to me. He said, because I think we had impressed him with the... He's way behind in listening to the episodes.
I think he's like 180 anyway.
He had listened to episode, I think, 47, where we talked about old school. And if I remember that one, we were talking about people. It was two guys that were paddling Labrador, and they're in, like, woolies and, like, old, you know.
No, I'm talking about the old way that we wouldn't hack it.
No, no, we wouldn't. We wouldn't.
Was it 47 or 42, somewhere in there?
It was way back then.
Yeah, way.
Way back then. So he
way
he was,
back in the day.
So he said it reminded him of when he first started, and he slept under a tarp with a leaned-over canoe.
Yep.
And anyways, he said back then he had something that was old school, and we should stay old school. And so he sent us a gift.
He did. And right. What did he send us? We just opened it.
We did. We did just open it. He sent us those. Think of the old school antennas on cars, the extension antennas.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent us blowy sticks for me and Sean.
Blowy sticks. I don't think they're actually called blowy sticks.
What are they called?
Fire sticks. Fire blowing sticks.
I call them fire blowy sticks. Blowy sticks. They're like in an antenna for a car.
Yeah.
And so you.
So instead of putting your face right down right into the fire and burning your beard off, you can stay a couple of feet backwards, blow through this tube as it's extended, and right down to the bottom. And you can place it right at the bottom of the fire where you need the air.
And activate it, get airflow, and venturi effect plus the what you're blowing. So, yeah, he said he used to carry bamboo sticks. And he said you could use them as a blowy stick to get the fire going or get relight charcoal or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or you could use it as a straw to drink your drink.
Or all three. Bamboo. Multiple uses.
Yes. So, yes. So, that's cool. That was very, very...
Thank you very much, sir. This generous, will get used.
Very generous of Raccoon. Thank you very much.
Very
cool.
Raccoon is a lover of, I think it's Sec Lake in Algonquin Park and...
Big Trout. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Big Trout was one of his first lakes.
Yeah, he loves going up there and fishing. Yeah. Fishing. We've never actually gone up there with him.
No, I've been with his brother.
Yeah, Ken?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bono's.
Yep.
So, yeah. So, it's very cool. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very, very much.
Yeah, we take all kinds of gifts and everything you want to send us. And money. We take money. Yeah. Big bills, preferably.
Yeah.
So, speaking of big bills, I ordered some stuff off of Amazon.
Okay.
And I got half my order. Just one little piece was coming. And if you don't pay for shipping, if you get over so much, you're entitled to free shipping.
Oh.
Right? So if I order something Friday, if you pay for shipping, you can get it on Saturday. Otherwise, you're not getting it till Tuesday. Tuesday works for me.
Yeah.
So I placed my order. All of a sudden, I'm getting all my stuff on Sunday.
Hmm.
That's why you never pay for shipping, because it always comes early.
I pay for Prime, so.
Yeah, I don't. I just get the free shipping. I don't care. Two extra days is
not
going
to kill me.
Prime
gives me all the movies and shows.
Oh,
and
Ariana pays for Prime, so we watch that.
We have a password. Yeah.
So then I get an email. The last item has been delayed. So they are going to refund me all my shipping charges.
But you didn't pay.
So are they going to give that to me in large bills? Like $0 and 0 cents? I think, wait a minute. Something happened here. So it arrived on Tuesday.
Oh.
Like it originally said it was going to arrive. So I don't know what's going on over at Amazon Canada here, but something just not adding up. Anyway, whatever.
I did something.
I got all my stuff.
I did something similar to my car insurance company.
Ordered a car and...
I was... Well, you don't get paper bills anymore, right? So it came by email. So I forgot it. So I didn't pay it. So they said, we're going to cancel your insurance if you don't pay up. So I paid up, but I paid up wrong. So I was like, I don't know, $5 or $10 short. So, and I was cranky by that time too. So, then they said, you're short by whatever amount. So then I was angry again and I overpaid by like $5 and they had to send me a check in the mail. It's like, screw you.
Yeah. That's like getting, things in the mail there. Oh yes. We owe you so much money. Like if you buy so much stuff at the end of the year, you get a check.
Yeah.
80 cents.
Thank you.
Why bother at that point? If it's under $5,
please don't
keep
do that.
It. Right? But anyway. So yeah, I'm waiting for my big wad of zero cash bills. Do they make a $0 bill?
They'll send you a check for $0.
And 0 cents. That'd be awesome. I would frame that and put it on my wall.
I think I'll overpay my insurance company by 1 cent next year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, our lives are hell some days. Free gifts, free money. That's really adds to nothing.
I remember I overpaid an electric bill once. I was supposed to pay $100. I paid $1,000 by accident. I didn't notice it until it was way too late. And
oh, try to get that money back.
No, I didn't even bother. I just didn't have to pay electric bill for over a year.
Right?
It's like, that oops.
Works.
Well,
that works.
Well, and I kept getting checks that they owed me money.
Paid in advance.
Here's your bill. We owe you $800. Here's your bill. We owe you $700. So, anyways.
I think I like when that happens, sort of.
Oops.
Except that you needed that extra $900 at the time.
Yeah.
What's new? You've been doing anything?
I have not been doing anything.
Really?
I'm supposed to go, and I'm not. I was supposed to go on a canoe trip next week, but I canceled.
Why?
It's just a bad time of year. We're so busy at work.
There's no bugs.
Yeah, I know. It was going to be a camping, hunting, fishing trip. So, way up north by Sudbury. They're leaving Sunday. I'm not.
And what exactly are you hunting? Like potato chips that are in
gross.
The Pringles can?
Gross season starts. So,
I'm hunting a charcuterie board.
Yeah. These are the boys from work. So, it's fishing and grouse hunting.
Ah.
So we traipsed around the woods shooting grouse. Then, like last year, we made a big grouse stew with potatoes and onions and carrots, and so good.
And you're missing out this year.
Yeah, I'm missing out, unfortunately.
No canoeing for you.
No.
That's your choice.
Yeah.
That's it? That's all that's going on?
Yeah, there's not much going on. It's just I'm just busy at work, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, that's same here. Just trying to get stuff done around here that we... Mm-hmm. Let slide for 3 weeks because we decided to go gallivanting the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So just catching up on all that stuff. I didn't get
what you're jet missing lag. Out is you're missing out on kids back to school.
No, we've been printing all of that for ages.
Yeah, my kids are back to school. Anyway, sorry. Woohoo! Because you're gallivanting. Tell me more.
Yeah, because I'm gallivanting all across the country. We had a bunch of stuff here or all across the other side of the world. We had a bunch of stuff here that didn't get done. So this past week's been doing all that and whatnot. When I got back, I did not suffer from jet lag. And that seems to be the number one question. So how's the jet lag doing? Doesn't exist. I got back early Sunday morning. Yeah. We went to bed and got up and did stuff Sunday, went to bed. And Monday morning, even though it was a holiday, Monday morning, 5 a.m., I'm poof, wide awake because that's when my alarm's supposed to go off on a Friday. And it's been no problems.
I would think that jet lag wouldn't you were gone 3 weeks, but I wouldn't think jet lag would affect you returning home.
Yeah.
Because you have a level of normalcy that you're dropping back into. I would think it would be affecting you on the other end because it's suddenly you're just like, it's 3 a.m., why am I fully awake?
Well, that's the thing is you're having like when it's 3 p.m. here.
Yeah.
You should be sound asleep.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And your body's trying to stay awake. But I'm having no problem staying awake. And then all of a sudden this morning, like well over a week later, I'm just like, my alarm went off and I did not hear it. And then this morning at work, I'm just like, but I'm thinking it's just because I've been having so many late nights and early mornings.
Yeah, just too busy.
And then, because then by the afternoon, I'm just like, okay, I'm perked up a bit here and fine. So we'll see what happens, whether jet lag. I get jet lag like 2 weeks after
It's a slow hit.
I get it. Yeah, I'm a late bloomer.
Yeah.
A late lagger. Do you remember we talked about that guy down in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes.
Who faked his death, the kayaker? Yes.
Yeah.
And, ran away to Europe.
And I remember when it first broke in the news, it was like, oh, missing kayaker. And I remember seeing it in the news about they're searching. And then little trickles of information started rolling out. It's like, wait a second.
Right? Right? So he faked his own death so that he could head to Europe in an attempt to start a new life.
Yep.
He came back after everything was found out and whatnot, and everybody wondering what was going to happen. He has been sentenced to serve 89 days in prison.
And?
The same length of time that authorities spent searching for him. Ryan Borgwart, 45, vanished on a fishing trip August 2024, leaving behind his phone, ID, and an overturned boat. Officials searched for his body, but later discovered he had fled to Canada, then to Georgia, of the former Soviet Union. Officials say he went to Georgia to meet a woman from Uzbekistan, who he had met online. Those Tinder things never work out, people.
How do you meet people from Uzbekistan?
How do you meet a Nigerian priest or a prince with billions of dollars to send your way?
True.
Judge's 89-day sentence for obstruction is twice as long as the term requested by prosecutors. We want to give him, 45 days. Nope, I ain't giving him 89. As part of a plea deal, he was also ordered by Green Lake County Circuit Court Judge Mark Slate to pay $30,000 restitution for costs spent by search and rescue crews who were sent to look for him. That's fair. He obstructed law enforcement for a total of 89 days.
Thus the sentence.
Mm-hmm. Before sentencing, he told court, "I deeply regret the actions I did that night and all the pain I have caused family and friends." Before leaving his wife of 22 years, he took out a life insurance policy, which we assume was never paid out yet.
Yeah, or else that he'd be charged for that.
Right. Transferred funds to a foreign bank account, applied for a replacement passport, and had a medical procedure to reverse a vasectomy. So you figure the replacement passport, would there not be some sort of penalty for doing that?
No, he legitimately renewed his passport.
No, he applied for a replacement one.
That's could be legitimate, he could say. So yeah, he got a replacement one because he, I assume, his was either expiring.
If there's going to be any more sort of
there's a lot of
fraudulent.
Yeah, he left a lot of breadcrumbs behind as to
I'm just surprised that he hasn't been charged with more. So I've been going through this and trying to figure out, well, he could be charged for this, that, and life insurance. I'm thinking he could be charged for fraud, but only if it had actually been paid out.
And it would have been paid out to his
wife.
Now ex-wife.
Yeah.
But
still, so it would have
been fraud on his part. And I assume if he had upped his life insurance or created life insurance, then maybe he was leaving that behind for his wife for the trouble of him leaving
but
her.
But for him to, now we've turned into a real crime podcast.
I know.
his entire plan to fake his death to devastate his family in order to serve his own selfish desires hinged on him dying in the lake and selling his death to the world. According to prosecutors, his plan was discovered in November after a Russian-speaking woman contacted him with authorities. A woman connected him with authorities. Her identity is not clear.
KGB.
Maybe. Law enforcement said they contacted him in an effort to draw him back home, later released a short clip of a video he sent to authorities. Said, "I'm in my apartment, I am safe, secure, no problem." By December, he returned to the U.S. and was charged with obstruction. His wife also filed for divorce.
Shocker.
I don't know why. He came back for her. I mean, yeah. His lawyer said on that he Borgward could have chosen to remain in Georgia, as the misdemeanor charge he was facing would not have qualified him for extradition, therefore no free trip home. If he didn't want to come back, he didn't need to come back, says his attorney. He came back from Europe to take responsibility for his actions.
I think things didn't work out with his Russian girlfriend.
That's what I'm thinking. Because her Tinder profile was not what she actually looked like. So, it was that fake eye and the one arm that did it. Yeah, crime doesn't pay, people. I thought he would have been hammered with more than 89 days and 30,000.
Yeah, I think the level of... So it's... His effect to society would be the false search for him. And... But he didn't really do anything illegal-ish. He still got charged for... Whatever.
I don't know, but it sounds illegal.
Yeah, and but he got a bigger sentence than they were asking for.
Yeah, but
so I don't know.
I don't know things like that. I think he should have gotten more. Yeah. It just reeks of, I don't know if fraud's the right word.
Yeah,
but on all, and he gives kayakers a bad name.
Yes, yes.
That's at the end of the day.
Just think, trying to think of the illegality. Like he did, it was a lie to authorities. He did flee. He did.
All the people of the town were all invested in this. Like, oh my God, this guy's died.
They're all a flutter.
And now they're all ticked off.
Mm-hmm.
They should all, he should be like, put in the old stocks, like the old medieval days. And people can go up and throw cabbages and tomatoes at him.
When he gets out of jail, he really should move states.
He's probably going to go back to Russia.
He didn't have to come back.
They should allow people to like stand in a line. And everybody gets one free throw with something rotted and mushy.
Did it say what he was charged with? Oh, for obstruction.
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 There's a broad word.
Mm-hmm. Charged with obstruction. They had to give him something.
Yeah, they gave him 89 days.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. They had to give him something. They had to. There has to be a deterrent for other people trying to do this stupid thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or just, you know, he had to be charged with something just because he was so stupid in his stupid plans to do this stupid thing, like leaving such a clear breadcrumb trail. It's like, dude, like...
Charge him with stupidity.
He's so bad at planning.
Why did you give him such a light sentence? We felt bad for him. We all in the opinion he could have done better.
He could have. He really could have.
He could have planned this much
because
better.
His new passport was scanned several times.
Right?
Right. Like, dude, like he should have just gone on a freighter and take the long road to the long haul to Europe and something, right?
Yeah.
But he's... It didn't say his passport was scanned at the border.
When we went to the airport to go to Japan and when we came back, the number of times our passport was scanned is phenomenal.
Yes.
You need it to get into this area. You need it to that area. You need to go through here. You need to go through customs. You need to go through security. Hold it up and he takes a picture of you. You go to the next point. They look at your passport. They look at you. You're going through the put all everything from your pockets in that little bin. It goes through the x-ray. You walk through the big... metal detector to make sure you don't have like piercings where you shouldn't have piercings. And there's a picture taken there and they're looking at that and they're looking at you to make sure it's the same. And the amount of times his passport just in the airport would have been scanned is phenomenal.
But if I remember correctly, thinking of all the times that I've crossed the border into the US and back into Canada, they just look at it. They don't scan it. There's no record that I know.
I don't think they scan it.
I don't think so. I've never seen them scan it. I remember looking out and seeing them hold it in their hand and look at the picture and look at you and okay, go ahead.
And they're thinking, God, you're ugly.
Exactly.
How did your wife marry you? Did she lose a bet?
He just made so many mistakes.
Right? So anyway, so we'll find out about. So I'll keep our ears out and see if anything else happens with this.
It's a very,
I gotta think something else is gonna come.
It's
down
a very expensive thing for him.
Yeah,
not well, $30,000. There's $30,000 of the jail time, but he also had his vasectomy reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's gotta be expensive in the States, yeah. Right? That's
and now
that's
he's lost surgery. His wife. So there's alimony.
Alimony.
He's
lost
his house and everything.
Or something.
Three kids. Yeah.
Three kids. And
yeah. So he's lost all that.
What an idiot.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anywho. Did you know there's more than 2,000 campsites in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness?
Over? Is there not an exact number?
There are more than.
So, 2001?
2003? 2000 and a half because one got burned? Of those campsites you can paddle to, one man has been to them all. Mark Zimmer.
Is there some that you can't paddle to?
Yeah. You can just derate at the side of the road or something. Campground, go to the end of the road. You don't have to paddle to them.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, hike to them. No paddling involved.
Mark Zimmer.
Yeah, more commonly referred to as the Barefoot Paddler, recently completed a goal to visit and digitally mark with GPS coordinates every campsite across the Boundary Waters Wilderness.
Did you see the video when he talked about it?
Yeah.
Did you see his GPS?
Yeah.
There's dots everywhere
right?
on the screen.
Yeah, it's just a giant dot.
Yeah.
Zimmer completed the mission Monday, August 11th. The final campsite he marked was on Topper Lake near Gunflint Trail. He is in the middle of his 13th year exploring the Boundary Waters. He typically spends late April or early May through October in the Boundary Waters, catching walleye, lake trout, and pike. Forages for wild edibles, including mushrooms, roots, and various fruits and vegetables that grow in the woods there. Fruits, I guess, would be like crab apples and berries and stuff. He paddles a solo canoe, sleeps in a hammock, and prefers to spend his time in the Boundary Waters without shoes. Hence, the barefoot paddler.
Hmm.
He previously created a downloadable digital map of every portage in the Boundary Waters, having literally walked them all.
Well,
find out more about Zimmer's portage map and learn more about Zimmer on his website, thebarefootpaddler.com. By next spring, he hopes to have the digital mapping of every Boundary Waters campsite available. In addition to the exact location of the campsites, people will also get a brief description of each site,
nice.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
These are personal observations and up-to-date descriptions that Zimmer makes while walking about and visiting each site.
Very
How cool.
cool
is that?
I would like that map.
Right? 13th year exploring.
13 years. Mm-hmm. Every summer. Like, he's either independently wealthy, retired, I don't know.
Or just taking trips all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
But
every weekend. He's got to be over there somewhere,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So the whole summer doing stuff like that. But yeah, you could do that. I mean, I'm totally drawing a blank on his name, but he, 100,
The 100 Lakes
100
guy.
Lakes.
The 100 Lakes in Algonquin Park guy. I can't remember his name, but yeah. He did a whole bunch of lakes in Algonquin.
So it's easy enough to do, right? If you just mark out your plans and everything like that, and then, get in your canoe. This weekend we're hitting these lakes. This weekend we're hitting these sites. This weekend. And it doesn't say he camped at every single one. He's visited every single one. So just like when we go to a lake.
There's some wiggle room there.
Yeah?
He had to have camped at them. They're
camped at some.
All those camps that you pedaled, one man has been to them all.
Yeah. Doesn't mean he's camped 2,000 sites.
I thought
it
meant that he camped at all of them.
No, he's just been. So when we go to a lake, okay, you're seven lakes in from where you've parked your car.
Yeah.
And there's six sites on that lake. That looks like a good site over there. Let's go. So you go, you get up into the site, you look around. It's crap. You get back in your boat, you go to the next site. You get
Do you
up.
You think that's what he did?
Yes. 100%.
No,
I don't think he's camped at 2,000 campsites
like
in 13 years.
That's like lying.
No, it's not. It says he visited 2,000. I don't think he's camped at them all. I think he's just visited them all, which is, and then he gives a little description. Hey, this site here, it's got a nice bench around the campfire.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place for two tents. The takeout is all rocks. The takeout's a beach. There's places to hang your food if you're of the hanging persuasion.
He did say he spent all summer doing this.
Right? So he could just hit all the campsites on a lake and do a little description of each one.
Hmm.
And then move on to the next lake. That's his daily thing.
So if you're, let's say 4 months, it's 120 days. It's 120 per year.
You're starting to mathematize.
120 campsites a year if you stayed at every one. Did it for 13 years. So, yeah, if you did 4+ months a year, and you could stay at every campsite.
If you're doing 4 months of camping.
That's what it says. He says he goes from April to October or something, didn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think it's straight. I think he still has a job.
He spends late April to early May through October in the Boundary Waters all summer.
You think he's in there for the full 4 months?
That's what he says.
All right. Yeah, I still don't think he's camped at every one. I think he just visits some of them. Because if you come across a site that's complete garbage, are you going to stay there?
So,
or are you just going to give it a description and move on down the lake?
So people who do peak bagging, it's like, I visited the trailhead. I did 14 mountains this year, but didn't climb the top.
Right?
All the 14ers. I hit the trailhead.
Yeah.
Didn't go to the peak.
That doesn't count then.
It's also not really comparable.
Yeah.
Because it's not like people are sleeping on top of the peak. Anyway.
They could if they wanted. Slackers.
They could.
Anyway, so that's a pretty cool regardless. If you go to barefootpaddler.com, then keep an eye out for when he has his map up of all the campsites and descriptions. And
if you know what, for trail information and for campsite information and availability and GPS coordinates and that, this would be a really good map to like for trip planning or for seeing what you can do and yada yada yada. That's
so Jeff McMurtry,
he did the similar thing with his
but
his
now
maps.
Maybe he needs to start doing all of this.
There you
go. Every portage.
He did.
Every campsite. Not personally.
Oh, no. Okay.
He did it'll keep him going for the next 20 years.
Because one thing that I found amazing with his maps is he does length, but he also marks on portages the height of land.
And changes.
The changes. Yeah. He's very detailed.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
You know what would really make.
Wait.
What?
You know, be really good is like you could poop in every Thunderbox in Algonquin Park.
Been there, done that. Mighty bold of you to assume I have not.
I pooped in every single Thunderbox in Algonquin Park.
In Algonquin Park. All right.
And I'm giving a rating out of 10 for each one.
Right?
This one is a little bit mossy. The lid is.
I declare this one 8 out of 10 slivers. you know what would be better to paddle all this?
What?
A set of robot arms.
Yes. Nice segue.
Thanks, pal. Sometimes the stresses of life start to pile up. We feel the need to get away from it all for a while. Everyone has their own way to unwind, but for Dave Nowinski, the ideal way to relax is to hop on a canoe and float down a quiet river, which is what one does.
Yes.
He doesn't find the whole part about paddling to be quite relaxing, however.
He's lazy.
A motor would make things easier, but at the expense of adding more noise to an otherwise serene experience. What is a stressed-out robotics engineer to do? Get robots to do the unpleasant work, of course. Now, you got to be careful, because there's a fine line, because this is how Terminator starts. If you want Terminators in the backcountry, it's guys like Dave that are going to start it.
Yep.
So he's come up with a plan to get a pair of robotic arms to do the paddling for him. He had a pair of Piper arms made by Agile X Robotics that would do the job, and he was able to borrow a canoe from a friend, so most of the hardware was all ready to go. He would just need a way to mount it.
Why would he already have a set of robot arms? Hey, these are in the closet. I think I'll use them.
Right? He's a robot engineer, so yeah. Why not? He's probably got a robot head there, too, in the closet, in the upper part.
Hmm.
You know how people have the mannequin head so they could do hair or stuff like that? Training to be a hairdresser? Maybe he's got a robot head up in the closet because he's training to be a Terminator builder. The mounting solution would have to be very light because the robot arms were only just barely powerful enough for paddling. It would also have to work without modifying the boat as it was borrowed.
Was it a very nice canoe? So from the video, it's like an old...
Yeah, but still, it's somebody's canoe. Yes, their pride and joy. True. Why ask for permission when you can beg for forgiveness exactly. later? Solution he developed was composed of aluminum extrusions anchored by pressure-fit braces that ran from one side of the canoe to the other. The Piper arms were mounted on the rails of either side of the boat. To control the arms, an NVIDIA Jetson Orin Nano was chosen, because we all know what that is.
I have no idea.
It has plenty of power, though, yet it is not especially expensive. So in the worst case, he wouldn't be out too much cash. The Jetson runs on ROS-based control algorithm. Again, we all know what that means. Okay, kids, get your pencils, pens out, write all this down, and Google it later.
Yeah.
And then send us an email and let us know what it means. the control algorithm that treats the arms as wheels using a differential drive. The video game controller supplies inputs, which are converted into speeds for the wheels. These speeds are fed into the hardware interface that calculates where each paddle is in its stroke, then uses inverse kinematics to determine how each paddle should move. The calculated joint angles are sent to each arm.
Hmm.
Shh, can you hear that? All the old people just dozed off. You can't exactly plug a canoe into an electrical output, so a Blue Eddy AC200L power station, big old battery pack, was brought on board the boat. It can supply 24 kilowatts of energy, 2 kilowatts of energy through both AC and DC outputs. That is enough to keep the canoe chugging along for a long journey, and it can be recharged via solar power if he accidentally ventures too far.
Hmm.
Sounds cool. So, he built it all. He installed it all. He tested it in the garage to make sure it all worked like it was supposed to. And then he went to the river. Boat was tested out in a local river, and it appeared to work quite well. It was not especially fast, but that was expected because the chosen robot arms were a bit underpowered for the task. Doesn't really matter, however, because... this isn't a speedboat. This is all about relaxation.
Huh.
This is more complex and expensive build than many that we see, so you might not be able to reproduce it yourself. Fortunately, you can live vicariously through Dave by watching his video on Dave's Armory on YouTube. Armory spelt the British way with a U.
Yes.
So go to Dave's Armory on YouTube, and you can see this canoe he's built with the two... and some of the comments are a bit...
I know. People are really picking him apart.
Picking it apart, like, you should do this with the angle. He took it out for a test drive to make sure it worked.
Yeah.
And people and are before
criticizing his robot's paddling technique.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your robot could do better. It's like,
and see, this way,
buddy.
Let's just criticize the robot before all of a sudden the robot is using those paddle blades to kill people.
To slice off heads.
Right? Let's just poke the bear. We'll get the robots out there and just poke until all of a sudden everybody's not happy. Except the robots, because they run the planet.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. Dave's not here. Because the robots got him.
Dave's not here, man.
That'd be cool, though. I mean, we saw it, and it looks pretty neat.
Yeah, it was neat.
I mean, like, if that's your hobby,
All the parts,
you know, yeah. Doing the robot, and you got the parts anyway, yeah. Then do yeah. something like that, right? Get out there. Do. If anything else, people look at it and think, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You're getting a kick out of it.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, you're not water skiing behind it, but that's not what it's meant for. But you can get a nice slow troll out of it, though.
Yes.
Right?
Very cool. I thought it was neat.
Well, that's what somebody else said, is like, now you got to get those arms to learn how to cast.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And when he catches a fish, the one arm starts turning and reels the fish in. Then all he's got to do is scoop it out.
Yeah.
Right? Dave's the man.
Yeah.
Yeah. We read and see and hear all about these paddling adventures.
Yes.
And we all wish we could do them. But who has 4 to 8 months to spend doing them? Because some of us have jobs and have to pay bills because the family wants to eat and they want clothes on their back and they want a roof over their heads. You got one of those families too, I know.
Yeah.
The money and the logistics to do that long trip. So a few years ago, the spring paddle shows and that, I did a presentation entitled, Is It Time We Redefine Adventure? And this story is a good example of what I was talking about. Because, yeah, everybody wants to do these grand adventures, but not everybody can. Because, like you say, you got your career, you got your job, you got your family, you got a, you know, responsibilities. Members of a Guelph, Ontario family are back home after an 1,800-kilometer canoe trip of a lifetime. They spent 9 years completing the journey, which started on the Speed River near where they live and took them all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. So you can even think they're really slow paddlers because it took them 9 years. Husband and wife Jeremy Shute and Leslie Horvath, their two sons, his brother, several other loved ones were part of the adventures. Sometimes it involved 10 people at a time. It's just magic out on the water, Jeremy said. It's a whole different thing when you pull into a city by the river. You see everything from the water. It's like a whole different place. The family paddled through lakes, down rivers and canals, taking in the front seat view of some of Canada's most beautiful waterways. Jeremy said the family did some organizing and juggling to get the time needed for the trip. Some of them took the summers off work and others retired or were enjoying the summer holidays from school. The trip started in the Speed River 2017. Each summer, they took on a new leg of the trip. They paddled out as far as they could for about 2 or 3 weeks, stopping to restock on essentials like food and water before heading out. From Guelph, they went to Niagara Falls, Mexico Bay, Quebec City, but their ultimate goal was always to reach the Atlantic Ocean. We discovered all sorts of things. It was real exploration. We didn't know where we were going to end up, Jeremy says. He says there were some scary moments on the water. We had these two ships passing us on the right with their big wakes. We were going up and over these wakes. We were way too close to the boat for comfort, and it was an uncomfortable situation. But that did not stop their adventurous spirit. When we went through the Lachine Canal in Montreal, we stopped at the Atwater Market for lunch. This was the first canoe trip where I actually marked fromageries on my GPS. Is that cheese stores?
Fromagerie, yes.
Before going, we would stop and get fresh bread and fresh cheese where we could. To figure out if they were getting closer to the ocean, they would taste the brackish water to see if it was getting any saltier. Then one day, all of a sudden, I hear a yell from behind my son, and he's like, taste the water, salt water. So we're thinking, okay, we're getting to the sea. We saw a seal, we saw shrimp, we saw kelp, eider ducks out in the sea, but that's not all. When they finally reached the village of Saint-Michel-du-Bellechasse, just downstream from Quebec City, they were greeted by a family of another sort at the entrance to the Atlantic Ocean, a pod of beluga whales. How cool is that?
I know.
Doing something hard, doing something beautiful, something meaningful, all of us together was a tremendous privilege, Horvath says. shoots 86-year-old mother Anne couldn't come along on the journey, but she's living vicariously through the stories her family brought back. They felt the energy of the river, of the belugas, loved all the people in the villages. It's so heartwarming to think that this world of woe and horrible things happening, that there are these special moments that really capture your heart. So you don't have to take, like, 8 months off in a year to do a massive...
You do chunks here and
there. Do little chunks here and there. String it all together. Yeah. And at the end of, well, like they say, what, 13 years or 9 years? At the end of 9 years, you've done this big journey. And, you know, like they say, like, there's certain family that joined at different times and such. So it all became a big thing everybody could take part in. That's a cool story.
We've talked about this family before.
I think we talked about when they first started. Yeah, like 9 years ago.
I'm hunting through our episodes to figure out when we talked about it last, but I'm not coming up with a...
Oh, it would have been one of the early years.
Yeah. We don't have an easy way to search our own episodes.
I know. We used to be able to put stuff in and it would search, and for some reason it doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe we need a whole new search engine website.
That's what we need.
Thingy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I'm done my paddling career, I'll look into that. Start at one, start listening.
Yeah.
And when you get to that episode, let us know. Yeah, it's anyway. So, yeah, so if you got something you want to do, an adventure or an expedition or whatever you want to call it, because, you know, not everybody thinks expedition is a proper word these days, whatever.
It is.
It is. It's my expedition.
It is what you want to call it.
Right?
Yeah.
If you got something like that you want to do, then... Go out and do it. Just break it into smaller chunks so it's doable. Nothing says you have to do it all in 1 year.
No.
Or
yeah,
two.
Yeah, you do it
in
9. Yeah, it's not like you have to quit your job and, hey, you know, I can't. If I want to do that, I'm going to have to quit my job and do this all at once. No, just do it like a week here, a week there, do chunks and pieces. The, like, what was it, Grant Brower, Peter Romaine, they did... The last couple of years, they did weekends and sometimes week-long things, and they did the whole Bruce Trail.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did it in
multiple
pieces.
Chunks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's doable.
Mm-hmm.
Find something you want to do, something you'd like to paddle,
yeah,
and make it happen. I mean, there's even there people do the Meanest Link in Algonquin Park.
In parts. Yeah.
Right? They'll do one leg.
Quarter sections.
You know, and then maybe like in the spring and then maybe in the fall they'll do a second leg and then next year they'll do another leg. And by the time they're done, they've done all the, what is there, four legs, five legs?
I don't know.
Huntsville to Rain to Cedar, Cedar to Opiongo back to Huntsville.
Yeah.
Yeah, so four legs. Yeah. So yeah, a couple of years you got all four legs done sort of thing, right?
It's like what, Mark Rubino and... And who else? There's a bunch of them. They were doing it in legs.
Well, I know they... Well, they did when they first heard... The first time they did it, they did it in 2 years, right?
So when I first heard about the Meanest
Link... Scarlet Brothers, Jeffrey, Mark Rubino, Jimmy Blacklegs.
Yeah, I can't remember. But yeah, when I first heard about the Meanest Link, first time I ever heard of it, it was these guys doing it in segments.
Yeah.
And that was like, whoa, that was 2012 or something...
That was way... Well, 2012 we went to... Was 2012 that we went to Woodland Caribou or 2013? Anyway, that was way back. Long time ago. Because we actually did a segment with them. We went down to New York State there, Scarlet Brothers.
Oh, I was with you.
Yeah, and then we did a second episode while I was there with the Scarlet Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
They were camping and paddling... In Algonquin Park, before a lot of these campsites were.
I know.
And they watched Sputnik go by.
Yes. To hear them talk about it and to hear the history.
Yeah.
Like, they talk about locations in Algonquin Park that are no longer there and dams that are long gone. And it's like amazing. You interviewed them and they told all these stories, talked about, you know, them being in Algonquin and seeing Sputnik fly overhead. And
it was cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So if you have something that you want to do.
Yeah.
It's doable.
Everything's doable.
Right? Nothing says you have to do it all in one go.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day you did because that was your job. Exploring.
Yes, exactly.
What are you doing? I'm exploring.
I'm going to the North Pole. It's going to take me 5 years.
Yeah. All in one go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not anymore.
Half of us are going to die, but we're going to do it.
Good times.
Yeah.
This one, it's one of our listeners, Michael Nichols. He sent us a couple things every so often because he reads a lot of articles, and I know said, hey, I thought you guys might, because he talked about something, and this is, you know, sort of
like it when
like
people
that.
Share with us.
He said, just another reason to be wearing your PFD because you never know when something might happen. Michael says, it may not be the weather or your skills, but the actions of others that determine your needs, which is true. You know, people say, oh, I'm a good swimmer and, you know, I'm not going to be paddling close to, or I'm going to be paddling close to shore, so I don't need my life jacket or that sort of. Yeah, but it's not necessarily just you.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you spent any time paddling the coastal waters, now you've paddled in this area-ish. You know how peaceful and sometimes how unpredictable the ocean can be. For small boaters, especially kayakers, one of the biggest risks doesn't come from the sea itself, but from other vessels that share it. Difference in speed, size, and power between a motorized vessel and a human-powered kayak can turn a calm day into a dangerous one in seconds. This was a case for John Laurie and two friends, Norman Lee and Bill Redpath, paddling in Sansom Narrows, a narrow body of water between Vancouver Island and Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. And of course, you've kayaked out that way.
No, I've been out here on board military ships.
Did you not paddle out there?
Most of my paddling was in near the harbor in Victoria, BC.
Oh, I thought you were out there as well.
No, I never went on any longer trips. Along Sauk and Esquimalt and Victoria, I never did anything further that would require overnighters. The club that I was in, I didn't have the confidence back then to join some of these bigger trips that these guys are doing. It was very new to me at the time.
I see. I thought you had paddled out farther.
No, I wish I had. But you hear stories.
You can go now.
I don't think I have the skills to do something extensive like this.
Well, no time like the present.
I would love to do it, but I'd have to go with somebody with a little bit more experience than me to
like
Alan Drummond.
Like Alan Drummond, Kingdom Outdoor Products, who does all the sea kayaking stuff.
Yes. I don't think he'd want to be responsible for my life, so I don't think he'd take me.
Yeah, but if you borrow my kayak and I pay him $20...
No, you'd definitely be
maybe
renting.
Maybe you back. Accidentally.
You're not going to fly your kayak across the country. That's too expensive. You'd rent one.
Oh, no, I'm talking about learning around here.
Oh yeah. I have my own kayak around here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got the skin on frame, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Anyway, they were alert, experienced paddlers doing everything right until they found themselves in the path of a commercial prawn boat barreling towards them. Rules of navigation are clear. Human-powered vessels have right of way. But what can you do when a bigger boat doesn't follow the rules? How can you maximize safety when sharing the water with faster, less nimble vessels? John and his friends were halfway across Sansom Narrows, paddling close together and keeping a careful eye on marine traffic. As responsible kayakers, they were watching a large commercial prawn boat approaching from a distance. First, the boat seemed to be maintaining a straight course that would pass them by safely, but then without warning, it turned directly at them. It was only about 75 yards away when it veered, John recalled. We thought, surely they see us. We're grouped together and pretty visible, but it just kept coming. At 50 yards, panic kicked in. The kayakers started back paddling hard, trying to get out of the boat's path. Just when it seemed like impact was inevitable, the boat passed by, missing them by only a few feet. No horn, no hail, no indication that the crew had ever seen them, which is the scary thing.
Well, it is. So on several levels, like when you're talking about a larger vessel like that, and you think to yourself, well, they don't see us. Are they not looking at the water for logs? Are they not looking for navigational issues? Are they
They would have the radar for that on a bigger boat.
Sure, but not everything sends back a signal,
mm-hmm.
right?
And, I don't know. I mean,
it seems like it was purposeful, just reading the description.
Right? Three kayaks together, you figure.
That's a big
That's group. A chunk.
You'd yeah. see that. You should see that.
Yeah. According to the collision regulations, the burdened vessel, the one with greater maneuverability, usually the powered boat, is supposed to yield to the stand-on vessel, like a canoe or kayak.
Yeah.
But in the real world, not every boater is watching for small craft. Not everyone is following the rules, and that's where things can get dangerous. You may know the right of way, but that doesn't guarantee the other guy does or that they're paying attention. So what can you do? Now, I know when we had to take our boater safety course to get your boater's
yep.
card so yeah. that you can use a little small fishing boat with a 9-horsepower exactly. motor on it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of questions about sailing and all that sort of stuff and the lee side of the island and the wind and all that. What do I care about all that? So none of that sticks in my brain,
yeah. Yeah.
right? So yeah, like so, but you figure somebody that's using this boat for employment, if it's yeah. a prawn boat,
yeah.
they would know
these rules. Yes.
And they would know that there's going to be other vessels out there.
I think they were messing with the kayakers.
Mm-hmm. So what can you do? Number one, stick together on crossings. When you're crossing a busy channel, don't spread out. A group of kayakers traveling close together is easier to spot and navigate around than one lone paddler 100 feet from the rest. Travel like a pod of orcas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stick together. Like, honestly, if you're going to be out there with a group of people, like, don't spread out too far because, like, powered vessels can come up pretty quick on you.
Mm-hmm.
And do you really want them trying to pick a hole between kayakers? Oh, I think I could fit between these two guys. Just keep your group together. Don't lag behind. Don't race ahead.
Yep.
You know, if you're in a crossing in a navigable channel, or if you're in a shipping channel, well, you shouldn't be in shipping channels.
Right.
So
you need to get across that channel ASAP yes. when it's safe yeah. to do so. But we've even been out and you see boats coming by and they come zipping fairly close.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With the waves.
Yeah, you leave right? a wake like behind.
You leave that wake behind. Yay. And just because you passed us without hitting us, you got that big wake
because yeah,
you're
exactly.
just rocking rolling yeah. through here. So, yeah, stick together. At two, adjust your path towards the stern.
Aim for the stern of their vessel.
If a powered boat is heading towards you and doesn't appear to be altering course, you may need to make quick decisions. One counterintuitive but effective move, turn towards their stern, not their bow. This places you behind their direction of travel instead of crossing in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they don't see you, and all of a sudden they say, you know what, I got to make up time, as you're thinking, I can beat these guys across,
exactly.
and all of a sudden they
yeah.
add more power,
throttle up. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, yeah, they're getting you right in the section, right mm-hmm. in the middle. Three, raft up for visibility, which these guys had done. If you're in doubt about being seen, raft up. Bring your kayak side by side and hold on to each other's boats. This makes it easier for other boats to see you, especially in low light or glare.
Or take all of you out at once.
Or take you all out at once. Go big or go home, as they say. Wave your paddle. Don't just assume they've seen you.
Yes,
stand exactly. your paddle up vertically or wave it side to side. This movement can catch a boater's eye more quickly than a stationary paddle. Brightly colored paddles or boats can make a big difference.
Yeah.
But they say that too. If you're out in the water and you need help and you see a plane, wave your paddle.
Hmm.
Right? Because I know with mine, my paddles are a bit shiny. My wet
okay,
paddles.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you wave it, sometimes the sun yeah. will catch it and add
exactly.
a little glare,
the wet,
a little
the wet paddle
blend.
Will be yeah. reflective.
Yeah. So it's like a little flash, mirror. Right?
Yeah.
Number five, keep watch and read the signs. Is the vessel keeping a steady heading? Has the angle relative to you changed? Are you hearing engine noise increase? Constant observation lets you catch early warning signs that something's off. Don't rely on assumptions. Watch for course changes and signs of crew distraction.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they're all out on deck doing something.
Maybe there's something on the other side of the boat and they don't happen to see that they've changed direction.
Maybe they're looking at a whale or who knows what they're doing, right? They might be looking at somebody else, some other stand-up paddleboarder, and they don't see you. And their stand-up paddleboarder is taller and you're shorter because you're in a kayak or a canoe or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe they just don't like you. Number six, use your VHF channel 16.
Yep.
If you carry a marine VHF radio, and you should.
If you're in coastal waters, absolutely.
Don't hesitate to use it. Channel 16 is the emergency and hailing channel. If a vessel is bearing down on you and you're unsure they see you, hail them directly. Vessel approaching Sansom Narrows. This is a group of kayakers off your port bow. Holding position, please confirm you see us. It's not being dramatic, it's being smart.
Yep.
Especially if they're coming right at you.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are.
Yeah.
And the closer that bow gets to you, they're not seeing
you. Oh, yeah, you get lower and lower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seven, if all else fails, paddle hard to safety. Sometimes you'll do everything right and still need to get out of the way fast. Don't freeze. Dig in and paddle hard at an angle towards their stern. Paddlers move slowly compared to motorboats, so every second counts. John and his friends there made it to safety, but it shook them up. There was this moment where we thought they must see us, and then we realized they don't, he says. By the time we moved, it was nearly too late. Sharing this experience of John's way of helping others avoid the same fate, sometimes safety isn't just about what you do, it's about anticipating what others might fail to do. Kayaking brings us closer to nature and to each other. It's an activity that rewards patience, awareness, and preparation. But we also share the water with vessels that can't stop on a dime or may not be looking for something as small and quiet as a kayak, canoe, or stand-up paddleboard. Stay alert, stay visible, and never assume you've been seen. That close call on Sansom Narrows could have ended very differently. Let it serve as a reminder to us all. When in doubt, take action. Your safety depends on it.
There you go.
Right? Yeah. I mean, there's a list of things to do, and you always keep your eye out. Alan is always talking about situational awareness.
Yes.
Know what's going on around you at all times when you can. And I mean, I use that in everyday life now. I mean, going through a parking lot, walking in the mall, like people on their phones looking down.
And people don't pay attention
anymore,
They don't pay attention.
I drive a Ford F-150, and the joy I get when somebody steps out in front of my truck with their face in a phone, I stop and just hammer the horn, and you know they're lucky they're wearing the brown pants that day. Just like deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, when they look and realize what they've just done.
I just stepped onto the street.
Oy vey, I'm so tired of it. Get your face out of that. And there's people I know that will be walking. I'll say, put the phone down because, you know, oh yeah, I'm walking and texting. Yeah, but you've just slowed down to quarter speed.
Yeah.
Like
in the middle of a hallway.
Put the phone down.
Or in the middle of a sidewalk.
Yeah.
People and are trying to stream around you like you're rocking a stream.
Right? And I'm not allowed to kick them, apparently. all these rules. okay, one last thing here. The water soldier. Dun, dun, dun.
Another invasive species.
Yep. In Lake Simcoe, an invasive aquatic plant, water soldier is not new to the province of Ontario, but it was spotted for the first time in Lake Simcoe last year, and the perennial aquatic plant is prohibited under Ontario's Invasive Species Act. Plant has long, thin, serrated leaves that grow in a circular pattern. The plant forms dense mats that crowd out other vegetation and may alter water chemistry, impacting native aquatic species. Water soldier can be submerged up to 5 meters under water, but floats to the surface in the summer. It will cut you up if you handle the plant or try to swim around the plant.
It's that sharp, eh?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is mitigate its spread, says Brooke Scryer, an advisor to the Invading Species Awareness Program with the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters Foundation. Water soldier is used as an ornamental plant in water gardens, the likely source of its introduction to the province. Plant is a severe risk to recreational activities and is a threat to wildlife such as fish, waterfowl, and migratory birds. Members of the Water Soldier Working Group quickly mobilized to survey the area when it was first spotted. The group includes government officials, indigenous organizations, conservation authorities, and other environmental groups. To date, surveys have shown the infection to be limited to Cook's Bay, but the worry is that it will spread to other areas of Lake Simcoe. Cook's Bay, I believe, is where we used to go ice fishing in the winter. You used to be able to drive your car out there in January. Not anymore. Right now, the work being done is focused on evaluating the extent of this invasion, and next steps will be managing plans for control and treatment. Judy Dwyer's property backs onto the lake, and the plant is already impacting her. She said she will wear gloves and pull the plants that are nearby her dock, but they come back quickly, and they can't go swimming there at all. Schreier says there has been a lot of support from various government agencies, but he hopes to see more funding from the federal government to help tackle the issue. Fisheries and Oceans Canada spokesperson says invasive species are a shared responsibility across federal, provincial, and territorial governments. In the case of aquatic invasive plants such as water soldier, the government of Ontario, in collaboration with municipalities, is responsible for the management of waterways within their jurisdiction. Federal government is part of a working group that collaborates to control the spread of water soldier within the Trent Severn waterway. And there was another, wasn't water soldier, and I'm not even going to remember what the name was, but there was another invasive plant species. Mm-hmm. That was there, and they had an area cordoned off. When we did the Trent Severn a couple of years back there, there was an area because we're going to cut around this island, and we couldn't because this invasive species was there. And if you paddle through, chances are you're going to drag it into other parts of the lake. In a few other areas of the province with water soldier, it's been extremely challenging to handle. Just getting the boat in and out, the canoe, kayak, just swimming off the dock or off a sandy beach really impede how we use our lakes. Looks like the top of a pineapple or a household spider plant.
Oh, okay.
And we're growing that pineapple upstairs. We've been doing it for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
You just cut the top off a pineapple, put it in water, it grows roots, and you plant it. That thing's huge. And it's sharp. And pointy.
Has it grown any babies yet?
Not yet. It says it takes about 2 years. So anytime now. I'm just waiting for that little baby pineapple.
Yeah.
If you see something like that floating in the water, especially in Lake Simcoe, the best thing you can do is report it. Experts recommend residents learn how to identify the plant and report the sightings through the invading species hotline, 1-800-563-7711. You can just Google Ontario invasive species hotline and you can get the number there.
Yeah.
But the faster they know it's there, the faster they can get there and, you know, stem the growth, hopefully, you know, rather than, oh yeah, that's been there for 3 years.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm looking at photos of it here online and, I Googled it. It says it's, the water soldier, it's native to Europe and Southwest Asia. It was first introduced to North America as an ornamental plant for water gardens.
Don't you have a water garden?
At my old house. Or
did you have water soldier in it? If so, where did it all
never
go?
Never did. It was first discovered in Ontario in the Trent Severn River in 2008.
Yep.
So it's...
See, that's how fast it...
And now it's spread. Well, the Simcoe is attached to the Trent Severn.
Yeah.
So now just boats and whatever travel through.
That's all it takes.
Dragon spores or whatever of it with them. And
yeah, that's all it takes. So if you find any winter soldier or water soldier, I'm thinking of Captain America now.
Yes, it looks like it does look like a spider plant, but a much thicker spider plant.
Yeah, find any water soldier, make sure you call the invading species hotline for Ontario and tell them where you've seen it and tell them to get their butts out and check it out ASAP. Because when it comes to invading species, the earlier, the better.
Yeah. I think in the future, it's going to be harder and harder because you don't have enough people caring about preventing invasive species, and somebody's just, hey, this will look good in my water garden. It's like people aren't thinking ahead of consequences. And oftentimes as well, people, you know, it's like there's a couple caiman, those alligator things, somebody discovered in a park in Toronto.
Oh, Grenadier Pond.
Yeah.
Yeah, and big goldfish.
Yeah, so people are just dumping their animals. And and the same thing happened down in the Everglades. People had these boa constrictors that were pets. They got too big for the house. Oh, let's release it into the wild. So
the pythons,
It's like, no, it's an invasive species. So people just don't get it.
Yep. But, I mean, and then people want to complain about Alberta's strict rules on washing boats and stuff like that, right? Yeah. Well, there's a reason. You know, because you can't replace the Rockies and all those little streams and rivers and lakes. And and once it goes through, it goes through.
Oh, that reminds me. So thinking of that, I was reading a thing recently. It's they're saying that when ducks eat fish eggs, because the duck's digestive tract is not that harsh. So if the eggs don't get digested, they do come out the other end. And so oftentimes if there's these remote lakes and rivers with a population of trout or whatever in it, it's because ducks flew there, pooped out the eggs, and so now there's fish in those ponds. So if you if you're in some high mountain lake somewhere or whatever, it's like, how do fish get here?
Well, ducks.
Maybe ducks.
Duck poo.
Yeah. So apparently, and elephants are the same way. They just stuff goes right through them, right?
Elephants go to northern Ontario lakes and deposit fish.
I'm saying how the digestive tracts of ducks and elephants and the civet cat and so on aren't that harsh, not that acidic.
Well, do you not remember what are the hats? Tilly hats.
Oh, yeah, they advertise.
Do you not remember the big thing that put them on the map was that an elephant ate a Tilly hat and a couple days later pooped it out, and all he did was wash the hat, and it was perfect.
Yeah, it was. He wore it again.
Right?
Well, the elephant really, I read somewhere, is this between 10 and 20% of the nutrients in the foraging that they do. It just, that they only gain 10 to 20%.
It just goes right through them.
It goes right through. So it's still edible food. It's still edible grass.
I'm not eating it. And I'm not wearing an elephant poop hat.
And so also with that, like, so not to get too far off track, I'll make it quick.
Too late.
So we've heard about the civet cat coffee.
Yes.
Heard about that?
Yeah.
So in taking on that, so for those who don't know, civet cat coffee, they've discovered in rainforests where the civet cats live, that when they eat the coffee beans, like the ripe fruit, like a cherry type thing, it digests the fruit and it poops it out. And if you collect those beans, it has a level of fermentation to it because it went through the internals of this civet cat. And so then when you process, roast the coffee, it's supposed to have a different flavor, a smoother flavor.
It's one of the most expensive coffees in the world.
Very expensive. But you have to process it through a cat.
Yeah.
Anyways, so there is a... I can't remember where it is, but there's a, it's an elephant rescue location where zoo elephants and so on, or injured elephants, go for a new life. And so they said, hey, well, elephants kind of weakly process their food too. So they started feeding all of these coffee beans, raw coffee beans, to the elephants. And so the elephant, they're pooping it out, and they're processing this elephant coffee, and it's not as expensive as civet cat coffee, but...
no thanks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kopi Luwak is the coffee.
Which are the elephants or the civet cats?
Civet cats.
Yeah.
Civet cats, a female civet that has given birth can be worth around $700, while a pregnant one can fetch up to $1,050. So my question is there a civet cat farm where all they do is feed the cats and collect the poop?
Maybe.
Like, you could put the coffee companies out of business by going there and building a giant civet cat farm.
Sure.
Corner the market on cat poop coffee.
And why not? Why don't we have a whole farm for squirrels, and we can milk the little tiny squirrels with the little tiny milking machines and have squirrel milk?
Don't they do that already? They do it with almonds. Get the almond milk.
Yeah. How do you milk an almond?
I don't know. Small hands.
But imagine who's gonna for the first time ever, before it's a thing, say, "Huh, there's coffee beans in that cat poop. We should try making coffee out of it."
Give it to Mikey. Mike'll do it. Mikey likes everything.
But seriously, who does that? Who sees cat poop and say, "Hey, coffee beans, let's
Who
make
sees
coffee.
A cow and goes, "Whatever comes out of those."
Well, that's natural. It's milk. Baby cows
Not
drink the milk.
Not 200 million milk. Years ago it was. or whatever.
People know what milk is.
Who was the first guy to look at a maple tree and go, "I'm going to take whatever comes out of that tree, put it in a bucket."
How did the indigenous first discover, like, who was the first one that, was it accidental? Like, the syrup came out of the tree and... I saw a story recently at work.
They boiled it because it tasted sweet or something. And then,
yeah, but how did they know to condense it down and boil it down to 1/40th?
How many people died before they realized which berries were good, which mushrooms were good,
yes,
and which ones were not?
Everything is edible at least once.
Like, how come those people are never mentioned in the history books?
Yeah.
Right? Here's Og, the guy that found out, don't eat those mushrooms.
Well, guaranteed it was some royal food taster of a king or something and said, I want to know if those mushrooms are
edible.
Healthy to eat.
Right?
Okay, start eating those mushrooms. Oh, he died. Okay, those ones aren't edible, right?
But... how do you know dude just wasn't allergic to those particular mushrooms?
True.
You would have to get four or five people to eat them before it became...
You'd have to be killing people left, right, and center.
Right? All the expendable food tasters.
9 out of 10 people did not die eating these mushrooms. I guess
so
that one guy was a weak.
Yeah. He deserved it.
Yeah.
Anywho.
Foraging, like the...
foraging.
What is it? The barefoot canoeer?
Paddler.
Because that's what he does. He's bored. Well,
yeah, you got to know what you're talking about.
If you're out there in the woods for 4 months.
Even if I knew my mushrooms, I don't know that I would forage and eat them.
No, I don't think I would either.
Yeah.
The
same
risk,
as some of the berries.
Because like when I for a short time started looking into mushrooms, and then there's a couple that was, oh, this one's
that
a
was
really,
back in the 70s.
But they talk about, oh, this mushroom is very tasty and it's good in whatever. It's got a whatever flavor taste to it. But be aware that it looks very similar to this other mushroom that's very deadly. It's like, wait a sec. It's just me and my eyeballs are going to save my own life. I'm not eating any mushrooms.
I'm not eating much. This mushroom is perfectly healthy. But if it has a tiny white spot on the other side.
Yes, exactly.
Next to a red mark that you may or may not see. Don't eat it.
The one with the pink ring around the edge is deadly. If it's got a red ring, it's healthy to eat. It's like, whoa.
How do we know that if I'm red and pink?
What if I'm colorblind?
Right? Then you're dead, apparently. It's like rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, I'm not going to forage.
Nope. No, I'm going to haul in all my food. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
All right, you got anything else to add?
I don't. I think I've said enough.
I have officially said enough. We've scienced everything to death here. Well, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream all our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.